And your honors, if it may please the court, my name is John Boserman on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Ibrahimi. In framing this case, I'm mindful of the children's literature of Alice in Wonderland, where the Red Queen says, sentence first, verdict later, and then never gets around to making a verdict. You know, the
marvelous judicial economy.
Yes. Even the conservative jurists haven't gone that far, though.
Why did the court have to find this man in contempt to enforce this property settlement agreement?
On a level of generality, it doesn't. There were alternative remedies available had the court merely allowed the plaintiffs or solicited an amendment to the pleadings from the parties involved. But the court never did that. I mean, the only thing that was pled here was civil, this strange hybrid, civil and criminal contempt, which I think is violative of other principles I've explained.
Well, you make a lot of assertions that the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, and if I can paraphrase the Princess Bride, I don't think that phrase means what you think it means. Clearly, the court has subject matter jurisdiction over divorce, custody, support, equitable distribution. That's all conferred by statute. So whether
sure.
The court could actually exercise that jurisdiction depends on some other things, but it certainly does have subject matter jurisdiction.
It's a very tricky concept of, you know, I know this has been in front of the court for a long time. There's been recent lines of cases that have helped clear it up. Maybe I could have phrased that second assignment of error a little more artfully, but essentially what happens is that it's a prerequisite. Yes, the court had passive subject matter jurisdiction here. Certainly it could hear and determine this rules to show cause.
What do you mean passive subject matter jurisdiction? What does that mean?
Passive subject, it's the inherent authority of a court to hear and determine a proposition. And they can do that in a rule to show cause. And they can enforce with their powers of equity their earlier laws and decrees. In this case, the court also had active subject matter jurisdiction in that both parties were personally before the court. I don't dispute that, and I've explained that in both the brief and the reply brief. And it had the inherent authority to hear and determine the cause of action before it, which was the strange hybrid of a civil and criminal contempt. Now, however, the only thing pled for, the relief requested, was the finding of contempt. And as an element of the damages to go along with that, the appellee asked for, who was the moving party here, asked for an award of attorney's fees. And when the court then makes a ruling on an award of attorney's fees but fails to rule on the only underlying cause of action pled, the court at that point lacks authority to make an award on damages without a finding on liability. There's no liability here for contempt. There's nothing in the record for that. I've been in front of judges where this has come up, where the plaintiff, if you look at this in one way, it's conceded from the record that the appellant had in fact paid off the support arrears. There was a dispute about the amount of attorney's fees that were appropriate and whether there should be interests. The matter was continued, and then despite extensive testimony presented, the only thing that was ruled upon by the court was the attorney's fees. There's no finding of contempt anywhere. Sometimes judges say, look, I'm going to reserve a ruling. Why don't you go see if you can come up with a compromise figure on attorney's fees? And I've even had Judge Klein, as a trial judge in Fairfax County, say, if I don't make a ruling on contempt, then I can't find attorney's fees, so I'm going to allow you to orally amend the pleadings to make this a contract action. Go outside and figure out what you're going to do for attorney's fees.
Specifically, at your assignments of error, starting with the first one, I understand your argument to be that because he was never held in contempt, the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction to award attorney's fees. Both the code and the marital separation agreement provide for remedies for enforcement of court's decrees, or in this case, the terms of the property settlement agreement. I gather you suggest that contempt is a prerequisite to that. In other words, if steps are taken to enforce the decree that don't result in a finding of contempt, then there can be no award of attorney's fees under the
That's correct. I mean, it's the appellant who brought this matter.
What your authority for that is, because the agreement says that essentially that any, if they're required to go to court to enforce, if either party is required to go to court to enforce it, then attorney's fees are awarded. I mean, it's really that simple.
The authority is, if you're going to go to court and ask for attorney's fees, you have to have an underlying grounds for that relief to be granted.
Well, there was. It was a failure to pay.
Yes, that is an element.
Grounds.
That is an element of contempt. But without a court making a finding as a fact and a conclusion of law that the defendant, Mr. Ibrahimi, was in contempt, how can they award attorney's fees?
Well, the court made findings of fact that he was in arrears and ordered him to pay.
Arrears do not equal to contempt.
I agree with that.
And under the Lange case, you know,
Let me finish, please. The way this works is, let's ask the questions and you try and answer them now. The court made a finding of arrearages, several findings of arrearages, ordered your client to pay. The agreement, it seems to me, broadly suggests that if you have to go to court to enforce the agreement, attorney's fees are awarded. The spouse went to court to enforce the agreement. Why isn't attorney's fees appropriate, irrespective of whether there's an actual finding of contempt or not?
So it is the spouse, the appellee, who chose the method which she approached the court. She chose civil and criminal contempt. Leave aside the issue of whether she had the actual standing to pursue the criminal contempt.
Why do you say she chose criminal contempt?
Because of the rule to show cause that was solicited by the appellee, she filed a verified motion asking that the appellant be found in civil and criminal contempt.
Okay. But if just because the appellee says something doesn't mean the court has hitched its wagon to that horse.
Yeah, the court did, because the court issued a rule that said, come to court and show cause, Mr. Ibrahimi, why you should not be held in civil and criminal contempt. They weren't pled in the alternative. They were conjunctive.
Okay.
And that's just absolutely contraindicated by the criminal case of Cantrell.
Remember the first question I asked you? And that was, why is a finding of criminal contempt a conditioned precedent to grant this court jurisdiction?
Why is a finding of criminal contempt
a conditioned precedent for this court to have jurisdiction to enforce this property settlement agreement?
When one elects their remedy, and this goes to Judge Humphrey's question as well, when one elects, such as the appellee, comes to court and says, I'm electing my remedy, I'm not pleading in the alternative a contract action to enforce the terms of the marital settlement agreement, I'm seeking the equitable relief of contempt, civil and criminal, and that's my choice. The appellee had the ability at any time to amend the pleadings after he had cured the arrears prior to the final hearing in March.
Okay, I'm lost because I'm looking at the operative part of the marital separation agreement, which was incorporated in the final divorce decree, and all it says is the parties agree that if one party incurs any expenses in the enforcement of any of the provisions of this agreement, the other will be responsible for and will pay forthwith any and all reasonable expenses incurred, including but not limited to legal fees, court costs, investigators' fees, and travel, period. Now, the mother went to court.
On an equitable remedy of contempt.
Let me finish, please. The mother went to court seeking to enforce that. A court determined, the circuit court determined father was in arrearage and gave him more time initially, ordered him to pay, and the matter was continued. No contempt order was issued, and it was the matter came up again, and he still was in arrears. And I won't belabor the record that you're familiar with, but the point is, at some point he did in fact bring the account current, and it seems to me under the clear language of the PSA, the fact that the mother had to go to court to accomplish that entitles, under the provision I just read, entitles her to be reimbursed for all reasonable expenses in that connection. It doesn't say anything about a finding of contempt being a prerequisite.
The That's what our I believe that's what our law and jurisprudence in Virginia requires. If you ask
for a case of that proposition, I'm looking at Arvin versus Sony Corporation of America, which certainly doesn't say that.
Arvin says if you must plead, you must include within your pleadings the relief you're requesting, and if you don't. If you don't ask for the relief in the pleadings, you don't get it. The only relief that the appellant asked for was civil and criminal contempt. There's been no finding of either civil or criminal contempt.
And so the argument is simply she got something she didn't ask for.
She got something she was legally not entitled to because the court did not make the necessary prerequisite findings based on the appellee's own.
If the court had found your client in civil contempt, would it have had jurisdiction then to order these attorneys?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would.
And alternatively, if she had pled, enforced the PSA and said nothing about contempt, would we have a problem?
We would not. I mean,
And we draw the technical distinctions all the time. But that's, as I understand your argument, it's a fairly technical argument of pleading.
It's technical, but it's a fundamental requirement of pleading. It's a constitutionally required fundamental precept of law. You cannot, if you don't have a ruling on the underlying relief requested, you can't just award damages. You must make a finding.
But
it's not just a fair cycle parsing or oversight. It really is required.
And the added layer here is the default because you weren't there at trial.
I didn't.
And so he was proceeding pro se.
He was proceeding pro se.
So we have one layer of argument, which is you got to plead it if you want to get it. And now we're confronted with, well, but some of this very specific arguments you're making weren't made at trial.
Yes, but the appellee was represented by counsel, and the court could have made a ruling on the count too. And the court just chose not to do so.
Okay.
I mean, I don't.
You're starting into your rebuttal, so.
Yeah, I realize that. I'll step back and let Mr. Patacci speak.
All right.
May it please the court. I'd like to briefly address the arguments that were made in order. With respect to the first argument, that attorney's fees were not sought in the pleadings, I cited in our brief the precise portions of the pleadings where attorney's fees were requested. That's at Joint Appendix 71. He responded, first motion to show cause. Please award attorney's fees. He responded on Joint Appendix 82 saying, I object to attorney's fees. After the non-suit, I refiled and again said, please award fees. Same request I made earlier. He again objected. So attorney's fees were unequivocally set forth in the pleadings. Number two, turning to the argument that has been made here that since there was no finding of actual contempt, we can't the trial courts could not award attorney's fees. I would respectfully submit that argument is quite unsound. Here's the argument. The argument is there's a court order that says you got to make all these payments, you got to pay on time, whether or not you're making $25,000 a month. You got to make these payments. He can resist, force her to jump through every hoop imaginable, and then after he's run up her attorney's fees, he's resisted till the 11th and a half hour. On the morning of the hearing, before court convenes, he can say, here's a check for everything you owe. I have now paid you off, and therefore you're not entitled to recover any attorney's fees. I point this out in connection with this argument. The trial court could not find him in contempt after he paid everything. He complied with all the provisions of the court order requiring him to make payment. Now, the trial court had not yet ruled on attorney's fees, but the attorney's fees were not yet quantified at the time the pleadings were filed, and that was the reason for the hearing, the attorney's fees. But under his argument, if you wait, and I would add this parenthetically, the trial court impliedly found that he was in contempt up until the time he paid off the arrearages. So under his argument, he can wait until the last day, pay everything off, we never get fees. We have a remedy. We can bring a breach of contract suit. Not contempt, breach of contract suit, get a judgment, then we got to go out and collect it. We can't enforce it. Respectfully, that argument, if accepted, would do grave harm to domestic relations law. The next argument, that we prosecuted simultaneously civil and criminal contempt proceedings. I have in the past, and in this case, said in my proposed order for a rule to show cause, the defendant should show cause why he should not be held in criminal and or civil contempt of court. However, after that initial rule to show cause was served, no criminal contempt proceedings of any kind were pursued or brought in any way. The other side acknowledges criminal contempt is a different animal altogether. Criminal contempt is for the purpose of punishment. Even if you violate a court order and you fully comply with all of its terms, even after you fully comply, a prosecutor can prosecute you for criminal contempt. It has to be brought as a separate case. There was no criminal contempt here at all. I would like briefly to respond to the last argument made in the appellant's brief, which he did not address this morning. And the argument is that the trial court should have disallowed all attorney's fees incurred before the non-suit. What we had here was a series of proceedings, and once Mr. Ibrahimi discharged his counsel and proceeded pro se, he resisted me at every single turn. Everything was a fight. I served discovery requests on him because when I went to court, when I was going to go to court to hold him in contempt, I wanted to be able to prove that he had more than adequate funds to comply with the court order. So I served discovery on him. Please tell me what your earnings have been. He resisted every step of the way. There was a non-suit here, but the non-suit would not have been necessary if he had either answered the discovery request and disclosed his earnings, or he had, at the end, consented to an extension of time. The only reason a non-suit was necessary was because he was fighting me every step of the way. And I would add that the morning I filed the non-suit, right after it was signed, I walked down the hall and refiled the original pleadings. So much, if not, though not all.
Let me interrupt you because I think that begs the question. He's certainly entitled to fight you every step of the way if he wants to. The law will permit that. The issue, it seems to me, is much more narrow, and it's simply whether or not, irrespective of the non-suit, all the preparation, everything you did, even though he was fighting you every step of the way, whether they were all expenses incurred to enforce this marital separation agreement. And I don't think he's disputing that that was the case. I understand the argument to simply be the non-suit sort of resets everything and nothing that happened before the non-suit can count. But I think we all know as lawyers that you just don't walk into a courtroom without doing a lot of preparation, lining up exhibits and witnesses and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, the issue, it seems to me, is whether or not the language of the marital separation agreement would encompass everything, irrespective of whether there was a non-suit taken at some point during the proceedings.
And the language is very broad. It doesn't say prevailing party. It says any expenses incurred in the enforcement of this agreement, including attorney's fees, shall be paid. And that's what we had here.
And at any rate, the effort that went in to the initial preparation would have gone in at the back end anyway.
Right? Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, to be precise here, I probably spent a couple of hours preparing a motion in non-suit and retyping the papers, signing them again. I mean, they were already in the computer. I had to print them out. Maybe I spent a couple of hours having to refile the non-suit. But the overwhelming majority of the work done before then was used to refile. I would just make this last point because I think it's not without significance. To the extent in his third argument he seems to challenge the award of attorney's fees, that is subject to... Let me go back a step. He did not preserve that argument for appeal.
Didn't preserve any of them.
That's right. But, I mean, he says he preserved the third argument, and what I would point out is this, that when I went to court to collect attorney's fees, Mr. Ibrahimi argued at length everything under the sun. And very briefly during the course of his many other arguments, several of which were factually incorrect, he did mention opposing counsel took a non-suit. But he never said don't award any fees for the non-suit, cut off anything for the non-suit. Right. In other words, the point I'm making is the objection, the argument was not preserved. And even if it was preserved, an award of attorney's fees is subject to an abuse of discretion standard of review.
I think you dropped your pen, sir.
I did. Oh. If the court has no further, I'll pick it up.
No. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Your Honors, there's two paragraphs.
Can I ask a quick question? Is it your understanding that the property settlement agreement includes an award of attorney's fees incurred for preparation in this court?
I honestly apologize. I had not previously considered that. I would say that it does not.
I presumed you would, but I wanted to see.
So there's two provisions in this settlement agreement dealing with attorney's fees. One of them says reasonable attorney's fees, and the other says attorney's fees. This is one of those cases where the general statement about any attorney's fees must give way to the specific, which said the specific provision, which says reasonable attorney's fees. Attorney's fees incurred in preparation for a case that's non-suited are per se unreasonable. And to take the position that the appellee does that, the court has the ability after a case has been non-suited, despite existing Virginia case law, to go back and recover attorney's fees for preparations incurred in the non-suit.
You know, if you're going to make the argument of the specific points to the general, in looking at the marital separation agreement, one paragraph, the part I already quoted, refers to any party that incurs expenses, et cetera. But then there's paragraph 11 says, if wife is required to seek court intervention to accomplish such payments, husband shall also pay wife's attorney's fees and expenses for doing so. So there's a specific and even more broadly phrased requirement that the husband pay wife's attorney's fees and expenses if she's required to seek court intervention, which she clearly did.
It doesn't mean any attorney's fees at any time whatsoever, even after case has been non-suited. And the only authority I could find on point says attorney's fees for somebody that's been non-suited are not recoverable. To award him the full $18,000 instead of the $9,000, without deducting the $9,000 that was clearly incurred prior to the non-suit, it's undisputed based on the factual record.
Even in the narrower version of the PSA, the reasonable, the court obviously has found these attorney's fees as reasonable because they ordered them. Is that a finding of fact?
That's a mixed question of fact and law. The court didn't say these were reasonable attorney's fees. The court awarded them. It's an abuse of discretion, and it's also it's clearly ignoring the obvious evidence of the record that $9,000 in attorney's fees or more were assessed related to the non-suit. It's a mixed question of law and fact.
Why shouldn't all the preparation, even though the non-suit was ultimately taken and the case refiled, it's the same effort to prepare the case, assuming the result was adverse to your client, why wouldn't he be required to pay all those attorneys?
Your Honor, forgive me. I see my time has expired. May I respond? All right. Non-suit wasn't the only option. The appellee could have asked for a leave to amend the pleadings, which is granted, asked for the appropriate relief rather than taking a non-suit. They never did that. She elects her remedy of civil and criminal contempt only, rather than asking for alternative relief of pleading to enforce the terms of the contract if Mr. Ibrahimi was not found in civil or criminal contempt. Why didn't she do that? And at any time, that could have been asked for, and liberal leave to amend would have been happened. She elected her remedy. She stands on her remedy. The court failed to make a finding under the only remedy for relief she sought, which was contempt of this strange hybrid variety, which is of dubious validity. But going beyond that, She elected a remedy, and now she has to be limited by that, and you have to look within the four corners of her pleadings, and if the court did grant the relief of contempt, you can't grant the attendant relief of attorney's fees. The Arvin case makes clear that...
How do you respond to appendix page 77, in which counsel says, there is my request for attorney's fees.
The attorney's fees request, I see. The attorney's fees request, Your Honor, that was made was attendant to the relief of contempt. The substantive relief requested was for civil and criminal contempt. The associated relief for attorney's fees was an element of damages associated with contempt. And the Arvin case makes it clear that when you ask for contempt, even if you've cured the contempt by paying off all the arrears by the time you get to court, which the appellant did, you can still get your attorney's fees because they had to expend it to bring you in.
All right. So time's expired. Thank you for your argument.